you have a comment or a question, it will be entertained, if not answered. Oh, good. Everyone's fully enlightened. We're done.
This is great.
He said, you might be leaving Cascadia.
Yeah. Well, I built a place in Port Townsend that was really kind of special. I built it with my own hands. But when I lost Copper Canyon Press to professional bureaucrats and Gray contracted cancer, she wanted to be close to her family, which was in Laconia and Mount Vernon. So we sold Cogion and I moved to Anacortes, and Gray died. Now I live in Anacortes, which is actually quite a nice little town. I have no knock on Anacortes, but I have no friends there. And I don't have much of a life there. And I've survived two heart attacks. And I need to have golf in my life to keep my heart functioning. I'm sorry, I'm not going to a gym. I'm just not a gym person. So if I'm going to keep my heart functioning, I need to have golf in my life. And here golf season is about 3 months, because I don't do mud ball. Golf in rubber boots is really not golf. And golf to me is also, besides being heart medicine, it's also walking Zen, and it's very important to me to have that walking Zen. So I need to have a social life somewhere, and I need to have some sunshine in my life. And I don't really have any reason particularly to stay in the Northwest anyway, because I never felt particularly welcome here. You know, people are not often grateful, as Seamus Heaney says, for having their moral shortcomings pointed out. And yet, that's kind of a requirement, it seems to me, of serious poetry. This is the only country in the world in which a poet is asked, why can't you leave the politics out of your poem? I mean, imagine somebody looking at Picasso and say, why'd you have to make that fucking picture of Guernica, you know? It made me uncomfortable. That's why he painted it. So it's all of those things. And also, frankly, I'm really fed up with this country. If I could, I'd just move to South America. I love Latin America. They get it. I mean, they really get it. And when we talk down there, when poets gather in South America, hundreds or thousands of people come to listen. That's been my expense, my experience in Latin America. 40 years in Cascadia, I love you all, but there's not very many of you. And there's a lot of people who resent the messenger. That doesn't mean I'm gonna stop bringing the message. It just means, you know, I'm getting tired of talking to deaf people who don't wanna hear. I'm deaf and struggle to hear. That's the difference. But the big one really, frankly, is more private than that. I need a social life. You know, after the loss of my wife, to be sort of stranded and isolated is just, it's really terrible. Just terrible at a day-by-day level. Whether I can afford to go anywhere, I don't know. But I'm going to take a real serious look at it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
How do you grab the fossilized shark teeth and pearls and put that onto a painting like that? Like, how do you get it into a book?
No, that's a great question. So what I do is I find those materials, and I have all sorts of equipment which allows me to take big stones or small pearls or whatever, and I grind it into finer and finer and finer powders. They're everything from, you know, mortar or pestle, grinding it by hand, to machines which really violently shake that material and pulverize it into really, really fine dust. it's an act which allows me to really study the inside of things that we usually don't get a chance to look inside of, both physically and sort of metaphorically.
You talked about the book, your books, I guess several of them, this mm-hmm. one and this one in particular, mm-hmm. Being including Sam's poetry. Did the poetry inspire the paintings that went on the pages, or did the paintings, how did that pairing happen?
Yeah. So this is part of this process that I really love. In the case of this book, there were initially other paintings of mine which I sent to Sam. Images, discussions, all those sort of things. Sam went to various openings, exhibitions. So he became familiar with my work and my process, and he wrote a poem which addressed that and presented that to me. And when I read that, I saw it as an invitation to then paint into his own observations. So these paintings came after the poems, okay? But because I also knew that I wanted to inscribe the poems into the paintings themselves, the paintings had to accommodate the actual physical structure, the actual typography of that poem. So it's a fairly complex process in there of making a painting which refers and is guided by that poem, but also is allowing a space for that poem to exist within it. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
And Sam, for you, what did his paintings provoke for you to write something?
Well, for that, you ought to read the poem. I don't mean that facetiously. I'm serious about that. I've written a lot of poetry of homage. Praise poetry is part of what I am as a poet, just as being political is part of what I am as a poet. First, I saw Ian's work as a book artist, an experience we share. I've worked with hand-setting type and printing on damp handmade paper and all of that. Not as well as he has, not by a long shot, but in that same tradition. And there's a whole vocabulary of that world that we hold in common. Anytime you hold a vocabulary in common with someone, you have family. The family of studio arts, the family of fine print, the family of poetry, the family of bricklaying, the family of politics. There's an interior language that you share that brings you closer together. I saw in his work what I might have been if I had been more of a printer and less of a translator or less of a poet or whatever. But I love that work, and out of that inspiration, I wrote a poem loving him and his work and talking about the materials that he used and the processes and so forth. And that became this. He took what I had said about previous work, and that motivated him, inspired him to take it in another direction and take another step. Meanwhile, I was still meditating on that process, and we had become great friends, and one of the great aspects of our friendship is drinking wine together. So the second poem was Terroir. It was about how we both love wine, and wine is of the earth. His work is of the earth. The things that he makes his ink from are of the earth. And I'm a very earthy poet, if you'll permit me. So the process keeps cycling through both of us. And each step, another step. Each step, another fresh breath. Each step, another refreshing of the vision. And a refreshing of the passion that we have, because you can't make art without real passion. You can fake art, but you can't make art without real passion. And, you know, real passion means putting your whole ass out on the limb.
What do you love about meteorites? And tell us about the history of the one you bought today and what you're
going to
do with it.
All right. Well, in the, this is a big question. it's true, today was a good day for me in the world of meteorites. I'm now the proud owner of a new one. And several years ago, I was in New York. I was at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Metropolitan Museum of Natural History. And they have this huge room, which is called the Arthur Ross Hall of Meteorites. And I was a budding bookmaker at that time. I just started making books. And I walked in, and on this wall, there are all these thin slices of nickel iron meteorites. And these are meteorites which are pieces of nickel and iron that formed in the hearts of asteroids. Okay, and these are bodies that are maybe 10, 20, 30 kilometers across. And they formed 4.5 billion years ago. And as they cooled at this unbelievably slow rate, these metallurgical structures began to form in them. And there are these crisscrossing of different minerals. And when you cut a meteorite and you polish it and you etch it, you can reveal these structures. And that's what I saw on this wall. And when I looked at those structures, I thought, oh my God, this looks like writing. They look like maps. They look like some sort of symbolic, logical structure that's inside of there. And my immediate thought was, well, hell, I want to read this. I want to translate this stuff into my own Homo sapien vernacular, right? And so I wrote that down in a journal of mine at that time. And you know, then you're like, well, I guess there's no way of getting meteorites, you know. And if I did, how in the hell would I process it? And I shelved the idea; it just disappeared. And about 4 years ago, there was a call for artists to submit proposals for an astronomy department. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I had that idea a long time ago. There's enough money in this for me to go out and buy a meteorite and try it out. So I wrote this proposal. And they accepted it. So what I did is I went out and I spent months trying to figure out how to get a nickel iron meteorite. I studied everything I could find out about these things, and ultimately purchased one. And what I then did was I cut it into thin, thin slices. And I polished each one of those and etched them so that I could reveal that pattern. And then I took it and I bound it back together with a great big hinge on the outside of it, and I turned that meteorite into our archetypal structure for reading. It became a book. So you can pick that meteorite up now, just like this. Hope you weren't saving your place. And you can open it up. And that act of opening it up is an invitation to every viewer to come and read that piece. They become the oldest books in the world. And it's a pretty abstract idea, but what I love is how many people have ended up rallying around it, and I have poets, multiple poets who are translating these meteorites now, writing their own poems. Jennifer and I actually presented this last night down in Portland at the Sitka Invitational, and people just are like, wow, that's fantastic. I have chefs who are finding recipes inside of them and creating meteoritic recipes, of musicians who are composing the music that they're reading inside of these meteorites. So I extend an invitation to you, to Sam, anybody who's interested in trying their hand at translating a meteorite into our current artistic lexicon, I welcome that. I want to see, because when we begin to contemplate these meteorites, we're contemplating our own origin. All the amino acids in our early Precambrian soup were introduced by meteorites. We are the children of these things. And it seems only appropriate to make a book out of that origin. Yeah.
How heavy is this book? How big is it? Where physically is it?
Well, they're very heavy. It depends on the. I've got made several, and so I don't know if you've ever held a big chunk of iron, like a sawed off piece of like a train track, but it's really heavy. It's really dense stuff. It's as dense as it gets. It's right at the very bottom of the top of our energy curve, depending on how you want to make that curve go. And they weigh anywhere from, you know, 6-7 pounds to 20-25 pounds. The heavier they are, I put them up on lecterns. They become like chained books, like your old chained books. And you can really read them and page flip through them. Yeah. I have them in my studio. I have there's one that's in the astronomy department at Whitman College over in Walla Walla, Washington, if you want to go over there. And hopefully I'll have a show over here where I can share some of them at some point soon.
And then what kind of paper do you use to put the
paintings on? I in this book over here, those are all done on what we call rice paper. That's a very, very thin paper. It's incredibly strong, but very supple, and it allows for you to for inks to sink very deeply into the actually fill the entire structure of that paper. In this case, it's a thicker paper. It's made by a company called Hahnemühle. It's the oldest continuous making paper company in Europe. They've been at it for about 450 years, and it's for
made from cotton rags.
Yep.
I made a book once, a small book. And to make the paper that was going to be wrapped around the boards for the cover, I cut up a bunch of my old jeans and put them in a paper beater and made paper for my old Levi's. And it's the cover of this one poem book that I printed called Requiem. Making paper is really interesting. It goes into this beater and it goes and it goes. It takes a very long time. And then you get a tray and you shuffle with the tray and the water comes out of that and the paper dries and becomes paper. It's a wonderful process. Once you get into the art of the book, you open about a dozen doors all at once that have to do with the composition of type, the composition of paper, and bringing all that stuff all together.
It's a really exciting process for that. And one of the reasons that I love to make books as much as I do is because they are doors to not only all these different technologies and materials, but they're also doors that lead to directly to other people. I love to collaborate with other people. And the book is a great vehicle by which I can do that. And it's given me the opportunity, in this case, to have an incredibly rare opportunity to really get to know Sam. And in a way that seems really direct and really, I guess, honest, to put it that way. It's something I really value and cherish, so thanks.
So I think now's a good time to give another hand to Ian. We're going to leave habitations there and edible earth there. Please be careful. Don't put any drinks or anything near it. We're still going to hang out probably in the living room and the dining room area. If you'd like to make a contribution to keep work like this going, there's a little basket there. You're welcome to put American currency in there. Thanks, Jake Lynn Evans, for videotaping this. That's very much appreciated. And thank you for coming. Thanks also to Sugwood Greater Seattle and the Sugwood International Cultural Association.
So if any of you want to come up and look at a book or anything like that, just come
years?
Grab a hold of me.